cup. I don't know what your pre-show ritual is. I'll actually ask you later. Ladies and gentlemen, it's your motherfucking boy, Gamero, the Pharaoh, the poor man's Robert De Niro. You know what I'm talking about? Bald version, but still beautiful. Oh, I am so very ecstatic for today's episode, ladies and gentlemen. Before we get to introducing the powerhouse of a guest that we have today, ladies and gentlemen, what are you doing? You know what I'm saying? Go on YouTube, go on Deezer, go on Spotify, all that good stuff, but more than anything, you go on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. That's why we got 72 cameras in here, so you can see our beautiful faces. Ladies and gentlemen, wow. How do I put into words the honor, the prestige that is before me? You know what I'm saying? Ladies and gentlemen, every Thursday at midnight, as you know, we have a brand new guest here at Midnight in Miami, Hallowed Halls. But today, ladies and gentlemen, it is a very important day. Ladies and gentlemen, the man that I have before me has graced the stages of Broadway, of off-Broadway. Ladies and gentlemen, the man that I have before me is one of the most talented individuals that I have had the privilege to have here in this here set. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my absolute honor to be able to introduce, for the first time ever on Midnight in Miami, we have Colin McPhillamy! Colin, how are you today?
Well, I'm overwhelmed. I feel like I've been hit by a media tsunami. This is amazing. Thank you so much for those kind words. And I'll just pass you $20. Very nice. Very, very much appreciated. And if you need any more, I'll leave it outside under the car. Fantastic. Anyway, it's lovely to be here, and thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you, Colin. Thank you. Amidst of a production, a tremendous production at that, that I've had the honor to be able to witness myself on opening night. Colin, talk to me. What has this experience been like for you from the very first moment that you heard that you would be partaking in this production?
Amazing. It really has been an amazing experience. It's a beautiful little play. It's quirky. It's unexpected. It derives its kind of inner structure from quantum physics, but actually it's a romance between two very unlikely partners. It's written by a British playwright, and one of the characters is an American girl, and the other is a British guy. So the casting—and that's how I was cast. I am a British guy, as you can probably tell, and my partner in the show is that phenomenal actress Marjorie Lowe, who's very well known in South Florida. She's worked up and down the East Coast at every theater in the state, pretty much. She's a Carbonell winner, and she's just fabulous to work with. And we have great chemistry together. We really like each other off stage, which you must have.
Yes.
Well, you don't always get that, but if you do get that. So she's a lot of fun. And the other thing is that what's great about it is that, as you know, Barry Newport has come in as the new artistic director at Gable Stage, and her predecessor was a guy called Joe Adler. And I adored Joe. He was crazy guy. I mean, and I never worked for him, although he offered me several projects. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be working each and every time. I did do one reading on a Monday night one time at Gable Stage. He was very kindly gave me the space so I could read a piece.
Oh, wow.
And that, you know, that was great. And we always, you know, he and I laughed a great deal. We really got on each other's wavelength. And of course, he was very well known in the region. He had done tremendous things. He started out doing Shakespeare for Kids back in the late 1980s, developed it into Gable Stage. He, you know, had a great talent pool of actors that he would work with and use regularly. And I really wanted to work with him and never had a chance. So I'm kind of thrilled to be able to work at Gable Stage, at least if it's not with Joe. And Barry Newport, who's come in, she was right at the other end of I-95, you know. She was the artistic director of a theatre up in Maine. And now here she is, as far south as you could possibly go without walking into the Gulf. And she has done a phenomenal job, I think, on this show. Every aspect of it, from the design, you know, in the lighting, the sound and the set, the costumes, there's a sort of unity of style. And she's managed to, it's not an easy play. It's quite challenging. It looks simple, but it's actually not.
Right.
And then also with a two-handed play, you've got to find a way to sustain the tension and modulate the rhythms and so on, so that it works.
Right.
You know, so that it's interesting for people to watch. I mean, it might be interesting and fun to do, but it's also got to be interesting and fun to watch.
Right.
Otherwise, people go to sleep. But so far, we haven't had that.
No.
And no, it's been great. It's been a lot of fun. We have one more week at this time of recording. We actually close on the 20th of November.
Yes.
And so, you know, it has been fascinating, I must say. It's an opportunity to delve into, like, this whole deal about, it's called Heisenberg after a quantum physicist called Werner Heisenberg.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another hook for me, because some years ago, I was in a play called Copenhagen, and that's a three-character play, and the character I played was Niels Bohr. And Niels Bohr is known as the father of quantum physics in the early part of the 20th century, and he mentored a guy called Werner Heisenberg. And that was a whole thing about who knew that quantum physics is, like, fascinating.
Right.
You can put it on stage. So that was another hook. In this play, the play's called Heisenberg, but Werner Heisenberg does not appear.
Right.
So go figure. But, I mean, no, great. Endlessly fascinating, to be honest.
You know? What was this the first time that you had read this play? Had you seen it before?
No, I didn't. I hadn't... seen it or read it. I knew the playwright by reputation. His most famous play is called The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which played in New York some years ago. And a friend of mine was in that. Funnily enough, this play was produced off-Broadway and then on-Broadway with Mary Louise Parker. And
I caught that myself.
Oh, you saw it?
I did.
Oh, cool.
Yes.
Oh, well. But the London production, which followed a year later, was a guy called Kenneth Cranham, who's a fabulous British actor. I was in a show. In fact, the last show I did in England before I came to America, which was in the late 90s, I was working with Kenneth Cranham.
Oh, wow.
So I'd always admired him as an actor, and I could imagine what his performance might, you know, the direction he might take. So I was thrilled, you know, to have a chance to play that same role.
Wow. What effect does it have on you, if any, when you take on a production that you've already seen?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I suppose it just goes in the back of your mind, you know, as a sort of reference. But if you think about it, it's like, you know, it's like singing a song. You know, two singers can sing the same song and it will sound very different. And so, you know, you can produce the same play. You know, like, one of the most produced plays are probably the plays of Shakespeare.
Right.
And the way that you can produce a Shakespeare play, the number of ways you can do it is kind of infinite, right?
Oh, yeah.
You can set them on the moon. You can set them in you know, 1,000 years ago, you can set them 1,000 years in the future. You can do them all male, you can do them all female, you can do them transgender. You know, there's nothing you can't do with a Shakespeare play. And I say that because I've been in a few of them. But I guess with this kind of with a contemporary script, there's this funny thing I think that happens with productions that you start. You think, oh, this could go anywhere. You know, we don't know what we're going to find. But as the production gets going, you start with a few days of, you try to analyze the text and agree what the play's about, or you share an understanding. And then it seems to me that little by little, you know, the production evolves until you end up with something that seems to be the only way it could have happened.
Yes.
Kind of thing. So in as far as that goes, yeah, I don't think you are usually that influenced by what you've seen before. It's kind of in the back of your mind, oh, I remember such a... Or if you saw something that somebody did that was particularly effective, you know, they managed to, you know, phrase something in a particular way that was very amusing or something, you think, you go, oh, I'll copy that. You
know, yeah. Talk to us about the roots of it all. Where, when, how did it all get started? What was the spark that set everything ablaze?
What, with this production, you mean?
No, in regards to your career as a whole. Yes.
Oh, it's an actor.
Yes.
Aha. Okay, so... way back in the last millennium, when I was about 5 years old, there was a school production of Swan Lake.
Okay.
And I played the evil Baron.
Okay.
And I loved doing it because it required me to leap and jump about the stage. Okay. But the problem was I liked leaping about so much, but this guy was meant to die. And so... there was only one performance. I remember the teacher was standing there in front of me going, and I kept leaping. so that was like my very first experience. I thought, oh, I like this, you know. But later on, when I began to be aware of what acting is, I had a friend at school whose parents were actors. I was about 12, I guess.
Okay.
And they were both actors. And there was a play called Charlie's Aunt, which was written in 1890s something. A very funny play. That one of a guy. It's three guys, and the two of the guys want to marry these two girls, and the third guy has to get consent. From the aunt, Charlie's aunt. So he pretends to be Charlie's aunt, Donna Lucia Dalvadores. And the line that keeps repeating is, I'm Donna Lucia Dalvadores from Brazil, where the nuts come from. Okay? It's been a huge, you know, it's been a staple of British theatre for decades.
Right.
And my friend, his mother took us to see a production. Well, I laughed so much that my face was in pain at the end of this thing. And then she took us backstage. And it was like entering this magical world. I remember we went into the dressing room. There were the bulbs, you know, around the mirror. And the friend was playing this kind of old curmudgeon of a character called Spettigue. And as it happened... 40 years later, I played that same character.
Wow!
At the Guthrie Theatre in Minneapolis. But then I was 12 or maybe 11 even, and it just was this fabulous, like the light backstage was like soft and magical, and his dressing room, you know, was covered in sort of well-wishing cards from everybody. And, you know, he obviously had a great time doing the show, you know, that afternoon. So that was it. You know, that was the beginning of it. Then, very soon after that, I think the same year, I had tried to read. I thought, maybe I could be an actor. What should I do? I should read some plays, right? So I picked out a play at random called She Stoops to Conquer, which is an 18th century British comedy, and it's a very good one. I couldn't make head or tail of it because the language was, like, old-fashioned, you know. And I was, like, trying to read this thing. And then the teacher took a group of us, like 10 of us, to see a performance of She Stoops to Conquer at a theatre in London called The Young Vic. And it was another revelation. Like, the women were, like, you know, they were sexy, and vibrant, and the guys were also, you know, sexy and virile, and the whole show was electric and very, very funny. And I was sitting there going, oh, wow, this is amazing. So then, I had the bug.
Oh.
So I started to act, you know, with like local groups in London. And then I went to drama school in London. But I kind of had a few years when I was in my teens, 16 to 18, where I didn't know the practical steps you had to do. In those days in London, if you were unemployed, which I was, you could take a class in almost any subject you can think of for £1 for like 13 weeks, 3 months.
Wow.
There was a publication called Floodlit, and it listed everything that anybody was offering a class on. And I used to like languages, so I took a class in French and Italian and Sanskrit.
Okay. Wow.
Right. and one of the teachers asked me, what do you do? I said, well, I work in a restaurant. I'm a waiter, but I really want to be an actor. And she said, I think I can help you. And I was like, oh, great. About 3 weeks later, she gave me a phone number, said, this man is an actor. Call him. And he'll be able to tell you what you have to do, you know. So I called this guy. He says, come and have a cup of tea. So I cycled. I used to go everywhere on a bicycle. I cycled. It was like 15 miles across London.
Oh, my God.
I'm going to meet a real live actor. What, you know, great. So we sat there. We had a cup of tea. He looked at me. He goes, okay. He said, you want to be an actor? That means, in England, that means you have to have an equity card. And that means you have to go to drama school. And then he said, I don't think RADA is right for you. I think you should go to Central. And I was like, I just sat there going, you know, like. So I said, right. He said, well, you must ask them for an audition. He said, have you written to them? I said, no. He said, there's the phone book, because this was before the internet.
Of course.
He said, look up the address. So he passed me the phone book. So I look up Central. He says, well, there's the number. He put the telephone there. He says, phone them up. I was like, it's that simple, right? So I called the number, you know. Yes, this is Central. I said, I want to audition. Ah, well, you must write and ask. I said, okay. So that was it. I had the address. I had to write, please, can I have an audition? And this man and I, we talked. His name was John Lyne. And we talked, you know, another, whatever, half an hour or something. He was chatting about what it's like to be an actor. And he had done everything. He said, I've done everything. Film, television, radio, theatre, except I've done everything except circus, he said. Okay. So he said, we'll come back next Saturday and we'll do some work together. So I got up to leave, and then he said, and it still makes me cry to think of it. He said, get that letter off for me this weekend, will you? I turned around, he said, it's worth a 10p stamp, isn't it? Because that's what a postage stamp cost, yeah. 10 pence. So I wrote off, they wrote back, said, yes, you can audition. And every week for 6 weeks, I went to see John. And we used to go in the park, and I would do a speech, a Shakespeare speech or a modern speech or whatever it was, and he would work with me to help to coach me, you know.
Wow.
And I was very, very shy in those days, and I used to mumble a great deal. I had no training. So I thought, you know, I don't know how this is going to go. And I remember as I put my hand on the doorknob to open the door to the Central School where I was auditioning, I remember this like electric shock of nerves. And I don't even remember how I got through the day, but they called me back. And then I went the next week, and it was similar, got through the day. And then I was called back a third time. So I knew it was kind of getting close. And finally, they said, yeah, well, we can offer you a place. And it was just the most magical thing.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so I was there for 3 years. And it was a wonderful experience and a wonderful training. It was very traditional, but it was very informal and very creative. I thought so. Not everybody had the greatest experience there, but most people did. And I thought the level of instruction was terrific. And some of the Central School graduates, Laurence Olivier, possibly the most famous actor of the 20th century,
right,
was a graduate. Judi Dench, Vanessa Redgrave, wow, and so on and so forth. You know, so that was it, really. That's when I got started.
Wow. Why do you feel like... So when you first contacted this person who was an actor, someone who was already established, they had already done so many things, and you were longing for a career in this field, yeah, why do you feel like they gave you the time of day?
Well, he told me later, John said, he said, as soon as I saw you, I knew you were an actor. Well... that was what he said. I mean, I wasn't 100% confident myself at that time that I was. I knew I wanted to be. But I guess he was a very experienced actor. He knew a lot of actors. He knew what an actor looks like, perhaps. maybe that was it. But also, he was just a very generous guy. You know, he had done a lot of teaching. And he, you know, the thing was to help young kids as much as he could.
How was your experience going to school, and as a second parter, do you believe that pursuing education in the theatrical field is a requirement when pursuing a career in theater?
Right. So how was my experience going to school?
Yes.
Well, I loved it, and I mean, we didn't. This is one of the best drama schools in Europe, and we never had an acting class. We used to learn by doing plays, so we were always working on a play. And in the first year, we just did three plays, but we did a voice class and a movement class, and we did stage fighting, we did makeup, we did dialects, we did all kinds of things. And in the final year, between us, we probably did 15 or 16 shows that year. It was like a company, you know.
Wow.
So we had a lot of training, and it was amazing. Is it necessary to do that to become an actor? No, absolutely not. For example, my wife, Patricia Connolly, who has had a very long international career on the stage and has played many classical roles and many modern roles, never had any formal training. She just learned by doing it. She's a little older than me. Actually, she's quite a bit older than me. But in those days, you know, she went from what she would do maybe 6, 7, 8 plays a year. So she was in companies, and she would learn from older actors who usually are very generous. You know, just pick up the kind of the technique, how to stand on a stage, how to make sure everybody can hear you. You know, those right. kinds of things. I mean, in terms of education, I think. I mean, generally, in an ideal world, if you want to be an actor, the more, I mean, this is my personal view, the more skills you can acquire, you know, everything. Well, everybody can type on a keyboard now. That wasn't the case when I was had graduated. You know, not everybody knew how to write a resume. Not everybody knew how to, you know, present. So I think the more you can, you should study whatever interests you. You know, I mean, it depends what kind of actor you want to be. I mean, I think it's so different now from what it was when I graduated. For example, in England, there were 120 producing theatres in the country. Now there are 30. Right. So
wow.
The scene is completely different. I mean, over the last 20 years, we've had this explosion of screen production. And there are different skills required. I mean, to play a great classical role like Hamlet 8 times a week takes stamina.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So it's good if you've done some yoga. Or maybe you can run half a marathon.
Right.
Because you need strength. to do that. And of course, it's very good for the voice and all that kind of thing. But that doesn't happen quite so often now, you know. And of course, if you get cast in a screen production, usually what's wanted is some kind of naturalism. So my wife often complains, if we see a film together, I can't hear what they're saying. You know, I don't understand, you know, because they mumble or, yeah, you know, all that kind of thing. But in general, I think, yeah, look, the more you think, the more you feel, the more you're open to, you know, the great works of art or not great works of art, any work of art, the more you try and be creative, all these things, you know, I think you should learn to dance, you should learn to paint. Hmm. And if you want to be an actor, you know, there's a really, the best way is to act.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. ladies and gentlemen, every single week, you know, we have three segments. And the first one is actually my mail time, you know. And in this beautiful segment, we ask our illustrious guest three questions that you yourself have submitted through the IG, through the DMs and all that good stuff. So here we go. Colin, the people, they clamor, they want to know, what was the biggest hurdle that you encountered while taking on this production?
This particular production?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. I think that finding the sort of balance between... I tell you what it was. It was finding how to... Because this is a story... My character is a man who lives a very solitary life, a very routine life. He's happy in his solitude. But he's not happy. He's... what's the word? He's regular in his habits and he's not looking to make any changes. And then he meets this kind of force of nature, this extraordinary woman, and slowly, gradually, he begins to open up. And so by the end of the play, he's experienced a complete transformation, really. Not, he hasn't become a different person, but what was potentially there has been released. So finding how to pace that, I think, was the biggest challenge. Working out how the change can come gradually. The play happens over 6 scenes. And when it works well, each scene is kind of distinct. You know, we're in a different part of that journey. So I think, yeah, from a sort of acting, technical acting point of view, that was it, really. The other thing is, I guess, you know, I've been an actor now for just over 40 years. 40 years ago, I never had to work hard to learn lines. That's changed.
Really?
Yeah. It's. I mean, you know, I still can learn them, but
of course,
I have to put in some heavy lifting, you know, to get it done. I think that's very common. As you know, you just do get older. You know, right. Your brain is not as agile as it was.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Second question from our mail time segment. What is the very first thing you do when you've agreed to a role?
Well, again, it's a cliched answer. When you get offered a play, they say, well, I'll send you the script. So you read the script. When you've agreed to do it, you read the script in a very different way because now you're looking at your...
Yeah! Yes.
So the cliche is you look at the script, you go, oh, bullshit, bullshit. My line, bullshit, bullshit.
Yeah.
My line.
Yes.
So I have to admit that it kind of happens now. Naturally, yeah.
Oh, my God. And the last question from our mail time segment. We do have 1 week left, so without any big spoilers, do you have a favorite moment in the show?
Oh, that's a really good question. Yeah, I have a couple of them. And now, what can I say? I don't know. Well, yeah. I tell you what, that there is there's a point where my character says, I've always wanted to wear a denim jacket.
Yes.
So, and I get to wear one.
I know, it's so good.
And I... and he's never has worn one before in his whole life. So that's, I like that.
Oh my God. Thank you for sending in those questions. Please send in those questions every single week and we will read them on the air. Colin, I'd be remiss if I don't ask, in an industry that has been impacted so harshly by the pandemic, by COVID, what was your personal experience like?
Yeah. Okay. Well, at the time, going back to just before the shutdown, my wife was in a Broadway show. She was in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, wow.
And I was in a theater also on Broadway around the corner in a show called Hangmen. So we were both on Broadway, and her show had been running about 3 months, and my show was in preview. It hadn't actually opened. And I remember on the Thursday, our producers came and said, well, we're going to do a deep clean of the theatre between the rehearsal and the preview tonight. And then the next day, the Friday, they came and said, no, we're closing down. So we thought, you know, this is going to be a week, maybe a month,
right?
You think? Right? Wrong. So this was in New York, obviously, and we had a place to stay in New York that the production, because we had moved out of the city some few years previously to be with our grandson. So we're living up in, you know, in Westchester, about 30 miles north of New York City. So we had an apartment. And it became clear that the show was not going, none of the shows were going to reopen anytime soon. So we had to get out of New York, which we did after a few weeks. And then, as you know, it was the best part of, it was almost 2 years, wasn't it? And we stayed pretty isolated. We really did. I mean, our neighbors got COVID.
Oh.
You know, we didn't lose anyone close to us, but we knew people who were quite sick, and in the town where we lived there were people who lost their lives, so everybody took it pretty seriously where we were. And then when both our shows came back and were reestablished, reproduced, so that was that was great. We were able to kind of complete that work that we were hoping and expecting to do. But it was tough. I mean, it was really tough for everybody, wasn't it? And during that time, there were a couple of kind of projects online, and people. I just admired the way everybody kept going. Really, it wasn't easy, was it?
Mm-mm.
Not at all. And I don't know if this has like changed theater forever, because now sometimes you're in the middle of a show and you happen to look out and there's everybody wearing a mask,
right?
Let's hope that this is finally under control. This is a historical event. Obviously, we haven't had something like this since the flu epidemic of 100 years ago. But there was a brilliant tweet I saw. In 1604, the theatres in London were closed because of the plague, right? So somebody had tweeted, when they closed the theatres in 1604, Shakespeare wrote King Lear. And then somebody had answered, I don't need that kind of pressure.
That's so true.
Right?
That's so true. Oh my God. What genius work is going to come out of this one?
Right?
Oh my God. Did you have any sort of creative outlet during the pandemic? Were you partaking in any of the virtual performances? Did you write? What did you do?
I did do some of all of that. I was lucky enough to be involved in a couple of, Zoom type productions, which I guess, it's almost like a new form. People are discovering how to use it. So some things were less successful, some things were more successful. Everybody was experimenting. And I have I've been writing as a sort of sideline for quite a while. I used to write short stories for BBC Radio back in the 1990s when I was living in England.
Wow.
And so I've continued that. I write a actor blog. I post something usually like once a month. Yes. Not very often. But
And where can our followers find that?
Yeah, well, I think the code, well, it's mcfillamy.com, and I think it's HTTPS.
They can see it on the screen.
Something like that.
Yeah, they can see it on the screen.
Ah, okay. See, I'm an old guy. I don't know. You're great. I'm not a digital native, right?
You have a blog. You're digital, you know, like, that's digital enough, you know?
McPhillamy.com.
There we go. Yeah. Wow.
So, so I did some of that, and then for quite a long time now, I've been seriously studying my other passion, which is astrology.
Wow.
And so I was able to kind of immerse myself in that while there was no acting to be done.
Right. How did you get started in astrology?
Well, when I was a kid, I've always known what I wanted to do in life. When I was three, I wanted to be a train driver. Then I wanted to be a milkman. And when I was about nine, I wanted to be an astronomer. And that was before I got hit with the acting bug. And then as I grew up, I realized that I really didn't have the mathematical ability or the understanding of physics to be an astronomer. So I became interested, and as I became more interested in theater, a large part of what astrology is mythology plays a large part in the sort of symbolism and the interpretive art. So it's really a hybrid of technical understanding of what the motion of the planets might mean, and a sort of intuitive approach of the mythology, particularly Mediterranean, Greek, Roman, Babylonian, Sumerian cultures. And I've always found the historical development of astronomy and astrology to be completely fascinating. And as late as the 16th century in Europe, astronomy and astrology were the same thing. And famous astrologers, Kepler, Galileo, were also astrologers, because you kind of had to be. It was really with Isaac Newton that the empiricism of the materialist approach to the physical universe took over. And of course, Newton was the greatest scientist who ever lived in the last millennium, gave us the foundations of mathematics, calculus, engineering, and so on. But I think that, interestingly, you know, we're talking about quantum physics, and when I played Niels Bohr, this great quantum physicist of the last century, to prepare, I bought a book called Quantum Physics for Dummies. Okay, and I was able to read four pages.
Right? That's two more than me.
I had to give up. I thought, you just have to fake it, right? It's gobbledygook to me. But I did understand one thing. And the one thing I understood was that a particle can also be a field. A particle can also be a wave, right? So at the subatomic level, a particle can be here and it can also be here. And what happens if a particle is the size of a planet? So, I mean, I can't extrapolate very much further on that, because I'm not a quantum physicist. But I know enough to know that the possibilities and the implications could be completely staggering. So what I'm really trying to say is that I think as our scientific understanding of the solar system has expanded, particularly in the last 20 to 30 years, so too it's perhaps there's a paradigm shift going on where it's becoming more acceptable in scientific circles to allow imaginative space to come into calculation. This isn't the prevailing paradigm at the moment. Most people will dismiss astrology as complete nonsense, which, you know, is fine. My response is you really don't know what you're missing. It's so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, apart from, you know, like the glib stuff, is this a good day to go shopping? Will I win the lottery tomorrow? You know?
Right.
I mean, all that kind of pop astrology. It's like reading a newspaper column to understand this incredible ancient art science is like trying to understand a Mozart symphony through an advertising jingle. You know, it's enormously sophisticated and elegant system. And of course, you know, there's plenty of disagreement within the astrological community of the right approaches or what works, what doesn't. But there's now there's an enormous body of research, particularly in the last 50 years. And there's, you know, there's a volume, there's a body of work which I think is intellectually respectable. There's a lot that's not particularly intellectual. I mean, as in any field, you know, there's a lot of nonsense gets talked. But I think that, I'm fascinated anyway. That's my story and I'm sticking to it. So, yeah. Actually, that was a long answer, wasn't it? You asked me how I got involved. Well, I went to an astrologer when I was in my 20s, and he said, "There's a big Australian flag behind you," and I went, "What? That's not astrological. That's psychic." Well, all my family is Australian, so
what?
Right. So I don't sound Australian because I lived in London and I trained in a British drama school, so I sound British. But I'm Australian, you know, by family, on both sides. Both my parents were Australian. And then this guy said, your life is Greek myths in the suburbs. And that has turned out to be exactly true.
Wow.
So I was kind of, you know, I was impressed by that experience. And then, so I was always interested, you know, but it's really over the last 10 years that as I've got older, and I thought, yeah, it's really time to look into this seriously. And wow. So, you know, there's a lot of information available now, and there are people who teach things that are worth studying, I think.
Of course.
Know. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, every single week, you know what I'm saying? We have three segments, and the second one is actually the movie review of the week. And in this segment, we ask our illustrious guest for a suggestion, a recommendation. I'm saying a movie, a TV show, maybe a theatrical production, anything that maybe you have seen recently that you would recommend to our viewers, our listeners, something that is ideally 5 out of 5 stars in your opinion. Whatever it may be, take it away. And you can do a film and a theatrical production. You can do, you know, whatever you'd like.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Juan. Well, I think there are two things I would nominate straight away. The first thing is, if you happen to be in New York and you fancy taking in a Broadway show, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. But the show I'm going to recommend is actually, well, it's slightly a period piece now, but the show is Funny Girl. And, of course, Barbara Streisand, it's what made her into an enormous star because she was very funny. And she also has that unique and incredible voice. But we have a slightly personal connection to it in that my wife's manager also has a client who was, in fact, understudying the part in Funny Girl, the Barbara Streisand part. And she had 2 months or so, where she actually played the role. And then the producers brought in someone with a larger profile, which is common, that's fine. But our friend, Julie Benko, gets to play every Thursday evening. She gets to play the show.
Oh.
It's so cool. She is so funny and she sings beautifully. And it's just an old-fashioned, good-time, fun show. It's just terrific. So highly recommend that if you happen to be in New York. Okay, so the other thing might be a little more unusual, and I can't remember the title offhand, but it's, sometimes there's a stage production and they do a simulcast, they film it and it's streamed. Yeah. Okay, so the National Theatre in London, so, you know, this is a niche piece of theatre. It's a British, it's English, I suppose. It's an updated version of The Rivals, which is a famous restoration play. And this has been updated by a guy called Richard Bean. He was the man who did One Man, Two Governors, you know, which is actually adapted and updated from a Goldoni play of the 16th, 17th century. And that, of course, has been a huge success, the One Man, Two Governors. And this, I can't remember the name offhand, but and I haven't seen it, but my wife has seen it and she adored it.
Okay.
We were talking about it yesterday. So what you should do is look up Richard Bean, National Theatre London.
Okay.
And you'll find it. And it's like set in the 1940s, you know. So it's very, and they just, they have great fun with it.
Right.
So those two things I would recommend. Otherwise, there's just so much. Is that, well, I suppose I've got to recommend The Crown, right, being English. I don't know, what season are they up to now? 4, 5, 6, 10?
Oh,
I don't know.
Might as well.
I mean, come on, that's like one of England's greatest exports. And it's the gift that keeps on giving, right? there's always a story with the royal family. When I worked in China, I had a few months working in China teaching English, and the students kind of assumed that I didn't approve of the royal family, because obviously, you know, they're in a position of great privilege. And I said that I did support the royal family because I thought it was a better alternative than a republic. But yeah, I won't say any more.
Oh, well, thank you for those suggestions, those recommendations. Please check them out. Colin, I do want to know, when you were mentioning being young and touching the doorknob to the audition and all those butterflies and those nerves coming on, comparing that moment to the very first time that you booked a role on Broadway, were you aware? Were you self-aware? Did you go back to that moment? Did you go back to the moment that he said it? What's the cost of a 10 pence envelope? You know, like, talk to me about that moment.
Sure. Yeah. I guess I had two moments like that. One was when I was back in England. I got a job at the National Theatre, and John Lyne, this man who had helped me so much in the early part of it, had said to me, he said, "We'll see you at the National." And then, you know, 10 years later, that came true. And so that was a big moment. You know, I did feel that's great. And the National was really, I was there when a man called Richard Eyre was the artistic director, and he had a talent for running the theatre very well. And there was open communication. It was a big organization, at least something like 110 actors. But, you know, and every department, the sets, the props, the costumes, the lighting, state of the art. And, you know, absolutely everybody the best at what they do kind of thing. Mm. And some big name actors as well. And they didn't pay star salaries, you know. That, of course, those people earned more than people like me, who was completely unknown at the time, but not 30, 40 times as much, 3 or 4 times as much, quite, you know, fair enough.
Right.
So it was very much, it was like, it felt, you know, part of the fabric of the city of London. It was like important. And of course, if you ask someone like me what theatre can do for a community, I take the view that the good practice of theatre is as important to the health of the community as the good practice of medicine or law or engineering or any profession. And if you don't agree, think about England in the middle of the 17th century when the Puritans took over. And if, you know, if you tried to do a play, they...
Yeah,
you know, they didn't like it.
Yeah,
they had no sense of humor. Yeah. And you know, if you think of places where it's difficult, or you know, certain political regimes won't allow you to practice the arts, it's life is bleak. So I think the contribution of theatre is incredibly important in terms of enriching the cultural experience of everybody. And I love the National partly because they went out of their way to make it accessible. So that, you know, there's a ticket you can be had for £10. Everybody can find £10. And, you know, the theatre economics are such that, you know, theatre is always going to be more expensive to experience than a film or, you know, TV or whatever it is. But I think if you can give someone three positive experiences in the theatre, you have them for life.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
And, of course, not every show you see is going to be life-changing, and it shouldn't be, because if everything was incredible, nothing would be, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But every now and again you see something that opens up a door or a window or a way you understand, or even for example, my wife just did a show called 4,000 Miles, and she was working with a very talented local actor, Gabe Salgado.
Prior guest on here.
Oh, okay, perfect. Well, maybe he said this, but he said reading that play, which is about the relationship between a grandmother and a grandson, made him take more notice of his own grandmother, and he went to see her. Well, I think that's great.
Yeah.
You know? So that, you know, it's that kind of thing, I think, you know. That I remember years ago hearing somebody talk from TDF, the Theatre Development Fund. If people have an experience of being in a play, they're, you know, 40% less likely to engage in bigoted behavior. They're 50% more likely to be more confident. They're 60% more likely to whatever it is.
Right.
But it's good for us. You know, we are storytelling creatures, and this is one way we do it.
Oh, wow. What's a story that comes to mind when the phrase, the show must go on, right. comes to mind? A story of something crazy going awry or whatever the case, and the show having to continue.
Okay, sure. I have one of those, I guess. well, I was in a play about World War I.
Okay.
And... it was years ago, and we were booked. We played a small venue in London, and we were booked to go to the Orkneys, which is off the northern coast of Scotland. It's a series of islands, and they have a festival there every midsummer. It's called the St. Magnus Festival. Okay, so our set was constructed of scaffolding poles and sandbags. So we were, you know, we're trying to replicate the trenches of the First World War. And we drove two vehicles through the night, the length of Britain, from London to a town called Thurso. And what happened was, at about 6 a.m., we needed to get some gas. And one of our crew, instead of putting petrol, gasoline, put diesel. And so 20 minutes later, the van stopped. And we had to get roadside assistance and what have you. So that delayed us. And as we drove into Thurso, we saw the ferry steaming out of the harbour. Okay?
Oh, my God.
Right. So we've got to get across. The stretch of water is called the Pentland Firth. And it's well known as being one of the most treacherous stretches of water in the Northern Hemisphere. So anyway, our director went around the harbour and he found a fisherman who said he would take us across the Pentland Firth, there are like six of us, in an open boat for £50 and all the beer he could drink. So now, fortunately... the harbour master heard about this and immediately put a stop to it, which is a good thing because I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be here talking to you. Yeah. Anyway, what we did manage to do was catch the next ferry, but we had to leave all our scaffolding and sandbags on the quayside and the mainland. So we went to the St. Magnus Festival with no set.
Oh, my God.
And we did the show.
Really?
Yeah.
No set?
No set. But that, you know, it kind of, well, maybe it was even better.
There you go, it worked.
It was a very generous audience.
Speaking of audiences, does that ever play a role in your performance? If there's an audience that, let's say, last night was very... their claps were very roarous, they were very receptive, and maybe today's audience is not as receptive. Does that play a role whatsoever or no?
Totally it does. Yeah, absolutely it does, I think. In fact, we had, on this show, we had just the other night, day before yesterday, a lot of people didn't show because of the weather, the hurricane. So I think we had 10 or 12 people, and they were very responsive. Maybe because it felt, you know, like a unique sort of, because it was, you know, just a handful of people. But and they seemed to find the play, you know, very amusing. And of course, laughter is contagious.
Oh, yeah.
In an audience, right? And it's all a question of luck, because if you have someone in the front who's laughing, you'll find that it gives confidence to the people behind to laugh.
Yeah.
And then if that same person is at the back, it's the same thing at all. So, yeah, I think it totally does make a difference. I mean, this is quite a... it does have some humour in it, this play, this production. Mm-hmm. But it's also a play where you really want to listen. So it can be very focused and intense. But it can also, you know, the range of responses is quite wide. And it does make a difference to, of course, because you have to, you know, if there is laughter, you have to time it.
Right.
So that you don't crash the next line and all that kind of thing. Yeah. So, yeah, it's always fun when somebody's amused, when people are amused. But at the same time, it's you know, if it's silent and you know that the audience is very attentive, that's great too. Yeah.
Do you have a preference between an intimate house and a opera multiple tier house?
Yeah. Well, I think so I suppose the largest theater that I've ever played was perhaps the Guthrie in Minneapolis, 1200.
Wow.
No, I did actually in China. I was in a much larger house. I'll tell you about that, but I think the great thing about a large house in a comedy, you know, if you hear everybody laughing, you think to yourself, where else do you get that sound of 1,000 people all laughing and, you know, having a great time? And there's something very, very positive and valuable about that, I think. I mean, but at the same time, I think... you know, if the play works, if a performance works in the moment, whether it's silent attention, whether it's raucous laughter, whether it's a mix, or if perhaps, you know, you can feel an audience drifting off, but something happens and you get them back. You know, every performance kind of has it works on its own terms or doesn't, or sometimes, you know, what you're trying for. You know, what I'm trying to say is I think the excitement of being a stage actor is doing it every time today, right? To be present today. You can't give yesterday's performance because it's today's audience, you know what I mean? And it's a disaster if you do. That's how things get stale, you know?
That's so true.
So, yeah, there is that, like, I don't know what it is, the silent sort of communication between the audience and what's happening on the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, you know what I'm saying? Every single week we have three segments, and the last one is the quest for the truth. And in this beautiful segment, we ask our illustrious guest a random, emphasis on the word random, question from this here deck of cards. I don't know what it's going to be, but here we go. Okay, I got one here. What's your best scar story?
Best scar story.
Yes.
Scar. Not
you
star.
Fell. Star. You know, scar. Whatever the case.
Yeah. Sure. Wow. Well, I do have a.
If you have scar. Any, I haven't seen any.
I do have a okay. scar. Yeah. It's hidden under this beard.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. So I have mine too.
Yeah. I fell through a window.
What?
Yeah. I was a kid. I was 8 years old, and I was on a balcony. I was on a balcony, and the door got locked somehow. And I was put banging on the glass, and suddenly I went through.
Oh my!
And I sliced my chin like that, and there was. So they rushed me to the emergency room, and it was kind of sewn back on because it was a big. It was, you know,
right.
It
was quite,
but they sewed it slightly crooked. So then later, and so it grew crooked. I was 8.
Oh my.
By the time I was 20, it was just not huge, but a little bit prominent. There was a sort of bulge there.
Okay.
Know? One time I got I was cast in a commercial where the camera was very, very close on me. And it was quite a challenge because so there was a makeup lady who kind of evolved a technique that would hide it. And then after that, I had to have some plastic surgery to kind of refit this piece of my chin.
Right.
So I did. And, but now I have a beard. So
yeah.
I don't always have a beard. So it's still there. I think it's got less prominent as I've got older. Not for a long time. Nobody said, hey, your scar. We can do something about that.
No.
I guess, you know, if I suddenly became a big film star, which may not happen now, I'm 65 years old, maybe they'd have to do some more stuff on my face. But no, I'm not going to bother now.
Wow. I had no idea. Wow. That is an action movie-like scenario. Thank you for answering that quest for the truth. Colin, what have been some of the biggest culture shocks when performing in different countries? You've gone to China, you've been all over. What have been maybe some things that is a norm, a staple in, I don't know, a South Florida theater, a New York theater, and then when you tried to do it in China per se, it was not normal. Maybe something along those lines.
Sure. Well, I think with when I came to the States, the first thing I noticed was that everybody works far too hard. Right. I don't mean they work too hard, but the hours are very long. The hours are long in theatre anyway, as you know. But in England, and certainly in Australia, you don't work on the weekends. I mean, you do when you're in performance, of course you do, because that's right. When everybody else comes to see you. But you don't rehearse on the weekend. You know, you just wouldn't think of it.
Right.
Occasionally you might do a Saturday morning, but not every week. But here, 6 days a week is the norm. So there's that. Okay. In China, it's hard to explain. I loved China and I had a great time there. But things are very different because you have to understand that it's kind of being reinvented. Well, now, you know, it's sort of 30 years. Actually, what happened, I think it was 1984 or 5, Arthur Miller was invited to direct his play Death of a Salesman in Beijing. And that was the first time that a Westerner had gone to put up a Western production. And then gradually other people were invited, and slowly a theatre began to be, you know, reintroduced and reestablished. But what you don't have is hundreds of years of tradition or ways of doing things that are established and understood by everybody,
right,
that you do here. So you're kind of, you know, making it up as you go. And I had the experience of directing the students at Peking University in an all-female Julius Caesar. And the kids were delightful, but they would work incredibly hard. They would start classes at 8 in the morning, and they'd finish at 6 or 7 or 8 at night, and then they would come to rehearsal. So getting everybody together to rehearse a play was very, very difficult. It was like, you know, herding cats,
yes,
as the saying goes. But it was very exciting and interesting and rewarding process.
Wow. Yeah. Colin, before we start wrapping up this powerhouse, this magnificent episode, first of all, thank you so much for joining me today.
My great pleasure.
Truly, I am ever so grateful for you and your time today. Before we wrap up, I do want to ask, what is something that you would tell a young aspiring actor, someone who's longing for that, that Broadway moment, that moment that they can recollect back to, you know, that moment in their childhood that they figured out that this is what they want to do. Mm. What are some tokens of advice that you would send their way?
I think the most important thing is, if I've always said to my own kids, if you need to do this, then you should. But if you don't... do something else. it's a tough gig, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it just is. There's no way around that because it's very crowded. It's very competitive. There's an awful lot of luck involved. There's all kinds of things that go into, you know, I personally have been extremely lucky. I'm not rich, but as I said, you know, in our line, they pay you in fun.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of fun. I've loved it. So I think if you feel called to it, you should try. And I think these days, and maybe this has always been the case, but maybe it wasn't quite so much when I started, you do need to have other skills. You do need to have a side hustle. You do need other things you can do to pay the bills.
Of course.
You must have that. That wasn't always the case. And, you know, maybe you'll be one of the people who get, you know, suddenly you're made into a huge star and you have a lot of success and you make millions of dollars before you're 25. I think that's very difficult for those people, you know, because, you know, to handle it is enormous pressure. Some people, you know, just don't cope with it well, and they... You know, they drink, or they do stuff they shouldn't, or they kind of act in crazy ways. And so I think that's very difficult. And the celebrity culture is very difficult. When it works well, you know, a life as an actor is just, it's really service to the community. You know, you're doing something which is culturally valuable, hopefully. And then, you know, there's the great variety. Every job is different. And I think the main thing is prepare as well as you can, you know, work out what you're good at, get very good at it, singing, dancing, acting, whatever it is, and try. And you know, you work it out, you pick your way. I don't think there's any one way to do it. I don't know if this is true, but I wonder if young actors think it's all about enormous success, and it's really not. I think that's, you know, if you think it's all about becoming a celebrity and, you know, having profile and all the toys and all the sweets, I don't think that is what it's about. I think it's about as I said, you know, I think it's about this valuable life. And it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. So if it doesn't happen in 3 years, you know, and you're still driven, you could give it a little longer. You know? Yeah. So I don't know. I think the reason I say that you should try if you're called to it is that if you're called to it and you don't do it, you know, there'll come a time in your life when you wish you had. But if you've given it your best shot, there's nothing to regret, no matter what the result. You know, you may not achieve international stardom, but you tried. And then you can look yourself in the eye and say, I did my best. And that's worth everything, I think. Yeah.
100%. Colin, thank you so much. Truly, truly, I am so grateful. I appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have one more week to catch Heisenberg at Gable Stage. What are you doing? Go on the link, purchase your tickets so you can partake, you can view, you can be in the audience for truly magic on the stage. That is the best way that I can put it. Thank you again, Colin. What do you have in the horizon post Heisenberg? Where can the people follow your blog? Well, we went over the blog. You can see it on the screen. Do you do social media or anything like that, or is not really your cup of tea?
I'm an old guy. You know, my kids know what to do. I struggle with that. I do the blog. That's the extent of my stuff. No, I'm actually planned for the next year or so to take it easy, sit behind the desk, catch up on my writing projects, So I'm going to do that for a while.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much. Well, this was great. What a lot of fun.
I appreciate that.
I love this show.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, every Thursday at midnight, what are you doing? You know, you go on Spotify, on Deezer, Apple Podcasts, all that good stuff. But more than anything, you go on YouTube. That's why we got 72 damn cameras so you can see our beautiful faces in here. And Colin, the last question of the show, I just want to wrap up. I wrap up with kind of a deep question, if you wouldn't be bothered by it. But here we go. Colin, if you could tell anything to the younger version of yourself who was just reaching out for that hand, the doorknob, and about to turn it in order to begin a new life, what would you tell him?
I'd say you are so lucky because you did try and you nearly didn't, but you did. And that's made all the difference.
Thank you so much. Ladies and gentlemen, have a wonderful night. Thank you for tuning in and we will see you next Thursday at midnight. See ya. Can say how you feel, midnight in Miami, when you can push it to the limit, it gets real with only one and ill, get locked into midnight in Miami, the podcast.